And it's no surprise that we're continuing on with our verse-by-verse series on the book of Revelation. It will be Revelation, Revelation, and Revelation for the term of your natural lives, I think. We are up to part 18, which brings us to chapter 6, verses 3 to 7. So, revision. If you weren't here last Sunday, in my opinion, the first horse or horseman of the apocalypse is mass deception. And that will pave the way for the final Antichrist. As the Nazis' chief of propaganda supposedly said, if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it, and you'll even come to believe it yourself. So what would be a really good, old, often repeated lie with which to deceive the masses? Well, I think it's the same one that's been around for 3.5 millennia, that God's chosen people simply aren't. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, Islam, medieval Christianity, Russia, Hitler, Stalin, Islam again. What better tool to pave the way for the time of Jacob's trouble than Jew hatred? And who would be first in line to embrace and promote this horseman? Well, the religion of peace has already deceived 1.9 billion people on the planet. About 1,300 years ago, Islam split into two main camps. Sunni and Shia, the minority Shiites, are the ones causing most of the problems today, for now. And Shiites await a messianic figure, the Imam Mahdi. Sunnis are coming to believe in him more and more. How does he arrive on the scene? Well, on a white horse, of course. Some say he's here already and they've seen his miracles. I take that with a grain of salt, but that's what they say. Point is, the Antichrist, the Imam, could sit briefly in the place where the sanctuary of God should be without necessarily the need for another temple to be built in this age. We also ask the question, could professing Christians get on the bandwagon with anti-Semitism? Well, too late. I mean, a number of Christian denominations and groups, and as we saw, the current head of the World Council of Churches have already done so. They've already promoting BDS, boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. So that's what we did last time. Today's menu will open the next three seals on the scroll. So here we go. Beginning in chapter 6, verse 3, when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come, who do you reckon this will be? Well, you're correct. It's time to release Wajah, the second of the four horsemen. Another came out, a red horse. Now, what's the significance of the colour red? Why a red horse? Now, I don't know about you, maybe I'm a sicko, but I tend to think of blood when I think of the colour red. So what's so special about blood? Well, you lose more than a couple of litres in that stuff in your daddy bones. That's one thing that's important about it. But there's an interesting relationship between the Hebrew word for blood and other important terms.
It's 11 o'clock.
After the flood, man was permitted to eat meat. However, Genesis chapter 9, verse 4, you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Now, the Hebrew word for blood is dumb, like dumb and dumber, right? Moreover, in Hebraic thought, blood represents life. You shall not eat it with its life, its blood. It's the same thing. Where it says here, with its living soul is what it says, benafsho, because the Hebrew word for your living soul is nefesh. So this is blood with its nefesh. Similarly, when God instituted capital punishment for murder, he said, verses 5 and 6, surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And where it says your lifeblood, that's in the plural. So it'll appear different to the singular term we looked at. Blood, singular, your blood would be, for a fellow it'd be damo. But here it says dimchem, which is your plural lifeblood. It would be damcha for a man. It's the plural, and so where it says, l'nafshateichem, that's talking about your living soul that's in your blood, That was a roundabout way of making a short point, wasn't it? Sorry about that. Now, every Hebrew word, as we've heard before, is derived from a primary root word called a shoresh. And related words have the same shoresh. So let's look at a couple of words related to blood. Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So if dam is blood, man is Adam. In fact, that's mankind, not necessarily man versus woman. Just like in English, we have a term for a man and a term for a woman. A man is Ish, a woman is Isha. Adam means all of mankind, or Adam. In Hebrew today, if you want to say a human being, you'll say Ben Adam, a son of man. We've heard that term before, haven't we? Genesis 2:7, and the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground. He formed Adam from the Adama. So blood and man and ground and dirt and soil are related terms. We're getting a picture of an earthy existence, aren't we? In Hebraic thinking, so this and living soul are all part and parcel of the same package. He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living nefesh, a living soul, which is contained in the blood. And the colour red, why is it red? Well, the law of first use is that the first time you see a particular word in the Bible, it usually teaches us something about that term. So let's check the colour red's first appearance in the Hebrew text. Genesis 25:30. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary. Actually, it doesn't. What it says is, please feed me with that same red. The word stew is not there. For I am weary. He actually asked for red. So here we have Esau selling his birthright for some red. His name, where are we? Is Adam, all the same root, isn't it? Therefore, his name was called Edom, red. So what sort of man was Edom? What sort of man was Esau? Immediately we know, don't we? He's not a spiritual guy. The Edomites became the sworn enemies of God's chosen line through Jacob. They included the Amalekites. They included Agag. They included Haman. We looked at that nasty piece of work in the series on Esther, didn't we? They included King Herod. And today it covers the region of southern Jordan where the so-called Palestinians come from. So we can probably guess what the red horse is all about. Let's continue with the rest of verse 4. To him who sat on it was given power to take peace from the earth. The word earth there in Greek, geis, means more than, it doesn't just mean planet earth, it means earth, country, region, occupied area, land, or the promised land. That they should kill one another. So war follows mass deception. Those who have embraced mass deception will fight against God's people. Now remember, this whole process is to bring Israel to cry out for their Messiah. But unlike the first horseman, he had a bow and no arrows, right? This guy was given to him a great sword. In Shia belief, the Mahdi carries a great two-pointed sword, a sword called a Zulkifar. And there he is wielding it from his horse in the bottom right of this photo. And by the way, this is from a YouTube video, this picture, showing kids how to make a model of the Mahdi sword with which he will slaughter all the baddies. What does Islam's holy book have to say about baddies? Surah 560, say, shall I inform you what is worse than that as penalty from Allah? It is that of those whom Allah has cursed and with whom he became angry and made of them apes and pigs and slaves of evil. And Islam teaches that the descendants of apes and pigs are, of course, the Jews. The second tier of Islam's holy books is the sayings of Muhammad called the Hadith. What does the religion of peace teach religion of peace, put my teeth back in, teach about the last days. Allah's apostle said, the last hour will not come until the Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. So the Jews will hide behind stones and trees, and the stone and the tree will say, O Muslim, O servant of God, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. You know, when you make a treaty with Islamic nations, do you really expect them to keep it? According to Islam, you may break a treaty with an infidel, and you must break it within 10 years. You can't keep your word with an infidel for more than 10 years. Forget Nicolae Carpathia and the revived Roman Empire, folks, ruling over the earth. This age will end with a final showdown between the sons of Cain versus the sons of Abel, which is the same thing as the sons of Ishmael versus the sons of Isaac, which is the same thing as the sons of Esau versus the sons of Jacob. So are we talking about world war or just regional war? We've seen this slide often enough. It shows Israel's protagonists from Ezekiel 38 and Psalm 83, their ancient names transposed to modern geographical regions. Israel's inside that little circle there somewhere. So will it be global or regional? Certainly start like that. Start regional, won't it? It's a good question, but one could potentially lead to the other, especially if some nutter starts firing nukes around. Now look at this here, AD 120. The Iranians have had nukes since the 2nd century AD. Don't tell me they're not making them. They've had them since AD 120. So that was meant to be a joke. They haven't really. I lied there. That was... I know, don't quit your day job, Michael, right? Yeah, okay. All right, I won't do jokes anymore. But the weird verse which follows the end times war in Ezekiel describes the search for bodies. Look at this. Ezekiel 39:14. They will set apart men regularly employed with the help of a search party to pass through the land and bury those bodies remaining on the ground in order to cleanse it. Will they do that straight away? No. At the end of 7 months they will make a search. Why will they wait 7 months? Decontamination? Next verse. The search party will pass through the land, and when anyone sees a man's bone, he shall set up a marker by it until the buriers have buried it. Presumably in their NBC suits or with their Geiger counters or whatever they have in the valley of Haman Gog. We've also seen the outcome of the last day's war in other teachings. The Bible predicts total destruction of some nations, Syria, Saudi Arabia, southern Iraq, and most of Jordan. Partial destruction of Egypt, northern Iraq, and northern Jordan, and that Iran will be defeated and scattered, but not destroyed. You say, well, aren't they the big problem at the moment? Fastest growing church in the world is in Iran. Praise God. Resulting in Zechariah 14:12, and this shall be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. Make of that what you will. The point is that Israel will be victorious, but only when they submit to their Messiah, nukes or no nukes. Which brings us to the third seal. When he opened, this is verse 5, when he opened the third seal, here we go, it sounds like it's time to release Whoopit, the third of the four horsemen. I heard the third living creature saying, come and see, and behold, a black horse. Now, what do we associate black with? In our culture, it's kind of death, isn't it? But I'm told that's not universal. Someone told me in China, white is the colour of death. You're nodding? It's true. There you go. I've had confirmation. I have a seconder. But in Hebraic thought, black is associated with nighttime. That is a time of danger, fear, and uncertainty. At the Last Supper, Jesus revealed his betrayer, John 13:26. And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Verse 30, having received the piece of bread, Judas then went out immediately, and it was night, when the powers of darkness reigned supreme. Not really. But that sounds dramatic enough, doesn't it? But what fearsome weapon does the rider on the black horse have? Well, he carried an axe, a spear, a Gatling gun. And he who sat on it had a balance in his hand. Really? A balance? No, not a balance like this one. Rather, a balance like this one. Probably. The word has a more common meaning. The word balance in Greek is zugos. It means a yoke for oxen or beasts. Or it can mean a balance. They kind of look alike, don't they? The sort of same sort of shape, maybe? Here's its more common usage, famous verse, Matthew 11:28-29. Come to me, all you who labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, my zugos, my yoke. But the context of the passage suggests that scales, as used in commerce, are intended. Verse 6, I think that should say, I heard a voice in the middle of the four living creatures saying, choinix of wheat for a denarius, and three choinix of barley for a denarius. Well, you know what the denarius is. That was a day's pay for a labourer, but what's a choinix? Well, I'll tell you. According to this chappy, that's Herodotus, 5th century BC, a choinix was a quantity of grain equivalent to one person's need for one day. So there. So instead of a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, you're talking about a fair day's work for 2,500 calories. Now, I doubt it's literal. There's a lot of symbolism in apocalyptic literature, isn't there? But literally, that's what it's saying. Now, the average Jewish family size in Israel is 3.7. So that's about 675 calories per person, per family, for one day's pay. Assumes your house and your car's paid off and everything, doesn't it? By the way, the little girl on the left is one of the lucky few to be released from captivity in Gaza last year. Worse for the average Arab family in the region, they're 6.2 average size, so that's 400 odd calories apiece. To put it another way, a labourer in Oz gets around $12.50 a week these days, about $250 a day. So food for one costing you $250. That's an expensive Big Mac, you know? Now, this is apocalyptic. It's not necessarily literal. But is the rider on the black horse predicting famine and insufficiency? Yes, I believe so. Famine is a common aftermath of war. Germany was starving at the end of World War II, and in Britain, rationing continued until 1954. But the last sentence in this verse is odd. Look at this. Don't damage the oil and the wine. What's that all about? Some have tried to link it to a decree from Domitian in 92 AD to destroy half the vineyards in Asia Minor. He later rescinded that, but doesn't mention oil at all. I saw it in a commentary. I would put it here, but I can't remember which one it was. Others say that these are luxury items, which means the affluent will be fine, only the poor will suffer. Here's a couple of commentaries that hold that opinion. I'm not sure that's right, though. Wine and oil were staples in the ancient Far East. God's covenant with Israel included wine and oil along with grains. Deuteronomy 7:13, and he will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your land, your grain and your new wine and your oil. Now, for their disobedience, it would make sense to disrupt supplies of all their necessities, and Joel describes a failed harvest as a punishment, with all four commodities in Revelation 6:6. Joel 1:10 and 11. The field is wasted, the land mourns, for the grain is ruined. The new wine is dried up, the oil fails. Be ashamed, you farmers. Wail, you vine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field has perished. So why spare these two commodities? Well, I guess they're a step up from barley and wine. But the most reasonable explanation I could find was in the Word Biblical Commentary, volume 52b, and it said, the intent of the prohibition is to lessen the severity of the famine. That is, an olive tree must be cultivated 5 years before fruiting and 15 to 20 years to mature. Vineyards also take several years to establish. That is, the scarcity of wheat and barley is a partial judgment. Apart from that, we might have to let that one through to the keeper. I don't know. So, in summary, in my opinion, the first horse of the apocalypse is mass deception that will pave the way for the final Antichrist, leading to warfare after mass deception has completed its work. We'll have war and then relatively short-term famine, not going on for centuries. And that just leaves one more horseman. When he opened the fourth seal, verse 7, I heard the fourth living creature say, come and see, it's time to release Wodowick, the Wapscallion, the fourth horseman. What will be the next catastrophe? Can it get worse? Chapter 6, verse 8, and behold, a pale horse. How pale? The word pale is chloros, it's hard to say, chloros. It means a pale green. It comes from chloe, which is a young shoot of a plant. So if you know anyone called Chloe, that's what her name means. Or his these days, I suppose. And I'm told, I don't know if it's true, but I'm told that chlorine gas is pale green. Never seen it. What's next? And the name of he who sat on it was Death. Oh, wacko. But that explains why the horse is pale, doesn't it? Because the first physical change that takes place after death is pallor mortis. And pallor mortis is the pale colour that light-skinned people like you and me tend to go within about 20 minutes. I believe it's a lack of capillary circulation. Not exactly pale green, but close enough. Is there any good news? Hades followed with him. Doesn't look like it. Hades was the Greek god of the underworld. It looks like he's got a lion or something there. He had a three-headed dog, actually. But is this who follows the fourth horseman? Well, some believe so. Here's a commentary that says there is no fifth horse, so apparently Hades is on foot and able to keep up with the horse. Maybe he's riding his dog. I don't know. But as we've seen in another series, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament made in the 3rd century BC, borrowed the Greek term Hades to translate the Hebrew word Sheol. And Sheol was simply the place of the dead, both the good and the evil, the good in paradise, the evil in Gehinnom or Gehenna. So is this literal? Was the third heaven with billions of souls in it chasing after the fourth horseman? See, I don't think so. It's apocalyptic. It's probably a symbol for lots of dead people. That would be my take on it. How many dead people? Authority over one-fourth of the earth to kill was given to him. I wish I hadn't asked the question. Bearing in mind, the word earth, as we saw, is geis. Country, region, land. It may be regional. A quarter of the world's population or even a quarter of the region's population isn't necessarily literal. We can't take numbers in the book of Revelation as 100% literal. They may be, they may not be. How will all these people die? With the sword? Well, that's the second horseman, isn't it? With famine? That's the third horseman. And with death? How do you kill someone with death? With deaths? Is that like death? Yes. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the word thanatos, which means death in Greek, is translated over 40 times as meaning plague or pestilence. And that's logical. That's logical if you've got a couple of million dead bodies lying around, especially if they're radioactive and no one's burying them. Now, this is not dissimilar to Jesus' prophetic teachings on the Mount of Olives, is it? Matthew 24:4 and following. And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. There's the first horseman. And you'll hear of wars and rumours of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet, for nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. Second horseman. And there will be famines. Third horseman. And while we're here, oh, and pestilences, sorry, that's the fourth horseman. And while we're here, in Matthew, our Lord also forewarned of earthquakes in various places. Now, much has been made of the dramatic increase in earthquakes over the last 120 years. I used to mention it myself, actually. But does this point to the end of days? I used to think so, but I'm not so sure now, because while wars abound, the number of deaths from warfare has thankfully decreased since the Second World War, for now. Similarly, death from famine has decreased over the last 100 years, and pestilences have decreased through immunisation although we're seeing some of these things making a comeback as people decline to get their kids vaccinated. When I was in Saudi Arabia, the official teaching of the imams over there was that immunisation was a Western infidel plot because it causes sterilisation in children. And so it was an infidel plot to stop the world from breeding Muslims. And so whatever you do, don't vaccinate your kids. So what do we make of the Olivet Discourse? Are things getting better or worse? Well, I don't know. It could be regional, couldn't it? I'd be interested to see the statistics for the Middle East region. I have no idea what they are. But in any case, the signs Jesus mentioned in the Olivet Discourse are the same as the first four seals, except for earthquakes. There's no mention of them in Revelation so far. So hold that thought. Back to being killed in nasty ways in our Happy Revelation series, I skipped over a bit in chapter 6, verse 8. And by the wild animals of the world, earth. Seriously? Killed by beasties in this day and age? Well, certainly a possibility in ancient times, wasn't it? Leviticus 26, 21. Then if you walk contrary to me and are not willing to obey me, I will bring on you seven times more plagues according to your sins. And what follows? Plagues or pestilences? I will also send wild beasts among you, verse 22, which shall rob you of your children, destroy your livestock, and make you few in number. So where there are mass deaths, perhaps predators and scavengers become more of an issue. I mean, presumably in a famine, people and animals become competitors for the scarce food supply, don't they? It all sounds jolly unpleasant. Is that it? Can we have some good news now? We've still got three seals to go. There's more unpleasantness yet to come. But that's enough for today, isn't it? Stay tuned. What can we take away from this morning? Things to think about? Well, the great delusion will lead to another attempt at ethnic cleansing of God's chosen people. In the wake of warfare, there will be famine and death from disease, possibly beasties as well. If the Lord returns within the next few decades, he will use an evil Islamic coalition to bring about the time of Jacob's trouble. If he tarries for a few centuries, all bets are off, could be anything. How badly, in this day and age, do you want to hang on to Nicolae Carpathia and the revived Roman Empire ruling the entire world? Just putting it out there. Next Sunday, Revelation, Revelation and Revelation. We'll pick up where we left off in chapter 6, verse 8, and we shall get through to the end of chapter 6, which means, would you believe, with a Christmas message, we'll start chapter 7 in 2025. Hasn't the year flown by?